we're back on tape, and we were talking about the way the program worked. And
right.
You were saying that you only had like one clinical year.
That's correct.
Okay.
Which is a little different than many other programs, and obviously mm-hmm. different than what the traditional medical mm-hmm. training for, you know, even for our MD students here are. Mm-hmm. And there are advantages and disadvantages of the program as it's designed. So the advantage, obviously, is that you finish in a much shorter, you finish 1 year earlier than if you had to do two full years of
right.
clinical work.
So it's 6 years for the whole.
It's a minimum of six years.
Okay.
And, you know, when I went through my training, the average student probably took 6.5 years. So half of us did graduate in 6 years, and the other half took 7 years, uh-huh. by and large, to finish. The program actually has changed over the years because the requirements for the graduate portions of the curriculum actually have greatly increased.
Oh,
okay.
Really?
Mm-hmm. So that now it's not unusual for students to finish in 7+ years.
Mm.
Okay. But then if you added on another year of clinical work,
mm-hmm.
you're talking about 8 to 9 years for the combined mm-hmm. degree program.
Mm-hmm.
And that's even before you begin your intensified clinical training, which is your residency and fellowships.
Mm-hmm.
So the other disadvantage, the disadvantages then of having just one clinical year is, you know, this has been debated back and forth for many, many years now, is whether the trainees are adequately trained to become MDs. Do they really have significant disadvantages, let's say, as an intern? And I think that this is clearly very individual-based.
Mm-hmm.
Part of the difficulty, obviously, is that you've been out of medical school for 3+ years,
mm-hmm.
and you got to come back, and you have to remember all the stuff that you've forgotten mm-hmm. from eons ago. But I think, on the whole, the students catch up very, very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, having the graduate training, actually, I think it helps one. It doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
Some people have argued that it's a detriment.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it teaches one to think in a very, very objective manner
mm-hmm.
and to prioritize mm-hmm. what the major problems are. Because, you know, you go in the laboratory, you've got 10 different things to do.
Mm-hmm.
Immediately you have to prioritize what experiments are to do first in the morning so that you'll be ready by the afternoon.
Mm-hmm.
And if one is very good about doing that, then clinical medicine in many ways is very similar. You know, most patients' problems are very complex. They may have 8 different comorbid states. And yes, you have to take care of about each one of them, but certain ones become much higher priority than others. So if you have that kind of skill,
mm-hmm.
then once you understand what problems are more detrimental than others and which ones you have to address first, it actually becomes a huge advantage.
Mm-hmm.
And I think most house staff directors would agree that while many MD PhDs have more problems at the beginning, at least as in the first months of one's training, by about 3 months, 6 months down the road, they actually are very, very outstanding.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I actually had, again, certain advantages because, again, I had a great PhD mentor. John Atkinson was a division chief of rheumatology at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And he dragged me on rounds for 3 straight years.
Oh.
Okay. I would attend clinical rheumatology rounds every Thursday during the academic year, probably 2 out of every 3 weeks.
So you really weren't out of the clinical.
Right. I mean, it's partly the vocabulary and the
mm-hmm.
jargon.
Sure.
Okay. And I didn't understand a lot of the stuff that was mm-hmm. being spewed around. But
sure.
again, you get accustomed and not get intimidated by the jargon, and
sure.
you develop a certain way of thinking about problems.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, actually, it wasn't that bad of a transition. It was actually
mm-hmm.
a pretty natural transition
mm-hmm.
from the laboratory back into the clinics.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And partly, I also like clinical medicine. There are
mm-hmm.
people that just don't like clinical medicine, but I like clinical medicine, and I like taking care of patients.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, it was actually very exciting
mm-hmm.
and a challenge to do this.
Uh-huh.
I mean, a lot of people tell me I'm crazy, but, you know, I loved my internship. Internship was one of the greatest times of my life.
Uh-huh.
It was a fun time. Mm-hmm. Residencies was a great time.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that's the difference between the one-year clinical work than the two-year right. clinical work than most right. other medical students, as well as a lot of the MD-PhD, other MD-PhD programs have.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, we'll get to your internship, but tell me a little bit about what you did in Atkinson's lab.
Okay. So John was interested in a family of proteins that make up a critical arm of the immune system called the complement proteins. So there are basically two general types of immune responses that one can classify the immune response into. One is called the innate immunity, which is the non-specific immune response, which you and I have, flies have, worms have, etc. And there's the adaptive arm of the immune response, which takes over after a few days, which becomes specific to certain organisms or certain types of antigens. So he was interested in the complement system, which at that time was appreciated to be the innate part of the immune response. And his laboratory fell upon two major topics. One was the proteins themselves, the complement proteins themselves, that circulate in the serum and are a critical component of the activation cascade. And the second component of his laboratory was interested in the receptors mm-hmm. that bind these particular proteins. So I was in the first camp in trying to understand one component of the human complement system, the fourth component of human complement system. But even though it was an immunology-centered project, basically it was a cell biological question, which was, how is this particular protein synthesized, regulated in the cell, mm-hmm. and how is it secreted, and how is, upon secretion, how is its activity regulated?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So during the 3 years I was in John's laboratory, we described basically how this particular complement component, C4, which in its mature form in the serum consists of three different polypeptides that are all bonded together by disulfide bonds. So, but nonetheless, this particular complex protein is actually synthesized as a single chain polypeptide.
Mm-hmm.
And we describe certain types of proteolytic cleavages that occurred within the cell in certain compartments of the cell that altered or broke it from a one single polypeptide, single chain polypeptide, into a three chain protein. And upon secretion, we further describe there's an additional cleavage event from the carboxy terminus of one of the chains, the alpha chain, that further allows the protein to now be increased in its enzymatic activity, because these things are enzymes in of themselves. So it was a very, very cell biological type of question. We really didn't deal with, at least my project didn't deal that much with the immune, what the immune function of these particular
right.
proteins. We were interested in using this particular protein mm-hmm. as a way of studying how processing of
mm-hmm.
proteins occur.
Mm-hmm.
So in that 30 seconds, I summarized two years of my life.
Well, you wrote six papers while you were at it, huh?
Yeah. I was very, again, very, very fortunate.
Mm-hmm.
And again, stepping at the right time in the project. So John had some inkling that, and based on other studies and other systems, that there was going to be this proteolytic cleavage in the human C4 chain. And the laboratory had spent a year trying to find a good cell line that would make the uncleaved form as compared to the mature form.
Mm-hmm.
So I remember when I entered the laboratory, you know, John suggested, well, after all, complement proteins are made in the liver. In that
mm-hmm.
time, they predominantly looked at monocyte macrophage cell lines, which also secrete the protein. And there was another laboratory, Arnie Strauss's laboratory, who had been working with this liver cell line, HepG2. So that was the first line I examined. And within 2 weeks, I sheepishly came into John's lab and I said, I think this is the right cell line. I think this is the right cell line for which it's making the proform. And I showed him the data that this thing is higher and the cleaform is lower. So after, you know, a year of hard work in the laboratory, I in 2 weeks had lucked out, basically, in choosing the right cell line. Mm-hmm. And, you know, once you had the cell line mm-hmm. to make the protein, the rest actually becomes extremely easy. I mean, not easy, but it becomes much easier mm-hmm. In describing a number of those other cleavages. Mm-hmm. So that, again, partly is the luck of just stepping in at the right time and having the luck of having the right collaborator mm-hmm. on the university who happens to have the right cell line. Mm-hmm. I mean, otherwise I could have spent easily another year mm-hmm. or more mm-hmm. trying to find the right cell line. Mm-hmm. Again, another matter of circumstance.
Well, we're going to spend some time probably tomorrow talking about serendipity. Mm-hmm. So we'll revisit this one a little bit. You know, the thing that strikes me when I listen to the way this program was outlined is it seems like if you weren't a very flexible person, this would be a little schizophrenogenic, because you're mm-hmm. a med student, then you're a graduate student, then you're a med student, then you're a resident, right. then you're, you know. But you seem to have been able to kind of flow along through it.
Well, I think medicine, good medicine and good research are not that dissimilar. Mm-hmm. A lot of it, obviously, is recognizing the problem, mm-hmm. trying to amass the data to be able to support one particular hypothesis versus another hypothesis, and then figuring out what to do mm-hmm. thereafter. Mm-hmm. Okay, so somebody comes in with chest pain, you need to figure out whether this is a cardiac problem, pulmonary problem, musculoskeletal problem, GI problem. Based on the clinical history and some preliminary tests, you set out additional, basically, experiments mm-hmm. to test each one of those mm-hmm. hypotheses. Mm-hmm. So the approaches that one takes in both camps, I think, are actually very, very comparable mm-hmm. to be good mm-hmm. In terms of being being able to diagnose things and be able to treat mm-hmm. them. Mm-hmm. The flexibility issue, I think, is true no matter what you do. Mm-hmm. Okay, whether you're in business, especially as we are scientists, because the technology and the approaches that one takes mm-hmm. this year versus 10 years ago mm-hmm. or 10 years from here mm-hmm. are going to be very, very different in terms right. of what's possible. Mm-hmm. So you always have to be very flexible mm-hmm. as to what challenges you're willing to take. Mm-hmm. What kind of approaches technically that you're willing to take. Mm-hmm. So you have to be adaptive. Mm-hmm. And I think if you don't, I think you fail basically in many, many different forms. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I think that's just the personality of the individual and the way that they've been trained. And I've been very, very fortunate because, you know, in each arena that I've had training in, mm-hmm. I have had really outstanding mentors that have certain strengths in certain things and strengths in other things. Mm-hmm. So on the whole, I've had role models for different kinds of things as represented by different mm-hmm. individuals. Mm-hmm. So for example, you know, Joe Lambert was really an outstanding role model in terms of stressing, you know, teaching, in terms of balancing life and work. Mm-hmm. Every summer, he goes on another archaeological dig. That's his hobby.
Oh, wow.
That's scientifically based. Uh-huh. So, you know, he tries to also work on methods of dating mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. certain archaeological objects. Mm-hmm. John Atkinson is also, I mean, he's a physician scientist. Mm-hmm. He's an outstanding physician. And he is a very caring individual, and he's an outstanding physician and scientist. Mm-hmm. So there are a number of things that I've learned from him mm-hmm. that I've not learned from other individuals. Mm-hmm. And then my postdoctoral mentor, who I'm sure we'll come to, Art mm-hmm. Weiss, was, you know, a phenomenally brilliant scientist, mm-hmm. or is a brilliant scientist. Mm-hmm. And he has certain insights into problems, mm-hmm. scientific problems, that otherwise, if you don't withdraw yourself from the problem and look at it from the whole, you just don't appreciate. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. He, you know, taught me really how to appreciate problem from the beginning to the end. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I've taken, you know, the strengths of all these mentors mm-hmm. as valuable experiences in shaping, obviously, mm-hmm. the person that I want to be. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it's still, you know, this is what goes back to the beginning of the conversation we had at this session, which is training continues. Mm-hmm. I still feel I'm in training. Uh-huh. Okay, that's really one of the wonderful things about science, mm-hmm. is that you're always learning something new. Mm-hmm. And hence, if one is able to adapt to that kind of philosophy and say, okay, I'm not the world's expert in this, because mm-hmm. if I was the world's expert in this, the answer would be already no. And there's mm-hmm. no reason for me to ask any more questions. Mm-hmm. Or at least put it this way, you know, you can't say that I know everything about this field, because mm-hmm. that never is the case. Mm-hmm. And if one takes that kind of philosophy into either the medical side or the research side, then I think actually you get the most out mm-hmm. of both. Mm-hmm. So I think there are lots of people that say you cannot be a good physician and be a good scientist. And I don't think that's true. Mm-hmm. I think the reality of the thing is that you cannot necessarily spend as much time as you would want to as a physician and a scientist. Mm-hmm. I think that's true. Mm-hmm. But I still think you can become an outstanding physician and an outstanding scientist mm-hmm. In terms of applying each one of those types of skills.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, let's do one more okay. thing, and then I know we have to break.
Okay.
Your residency. Mm-hmm. How did you decide on internal medicine?
The two fields that I think many people go through the following procedure. Mm-hmm. So first of all, you eliminate everything that you don't like to do.
Yeah.
Okay. Right. So in the end, for me, it was either medicine or pediatrics. Mm-hmm. Okay, internal medicine or pediatrics. And that was even till the beginning of the year that I actually choose the residency. Mm-hmm. So I did medicine, and it was as I thought it was, because you know I'd been around all the medicine people mm-hmm. anyway. Mm-hmm. And I did pediatrics, and I actually liked pediatrics. But there were a couple reasons why I chose medicine over pediatrics. One was there are lots more social issues that one has to deal with in pediatrics than internal medicine. So that was one factor. The second factor, in part, was adults make the choices, and they had to live with the consequences of those choices. Mm-hmm. Children don't make choices. The parents make the choices, and yet the children had to live with the consequences of the parents' choices, mm-hmm. which actually many times makes it extremely hard for one to become a pediatrician, I think. Because you have no control over the situation. You just can't say, you don't take the medicine, you're going to have a heart attack. Mm-hmm. End the story. And that I found actually more difficult mm-hmm. to accept. Mm-hmm. Because there's nothing I could have done about it, or very few things I can do about it to mm-hmm. control not only the patient's mm-hmm. Behavior, but the parent's behavior. Mm-hmm. And the third thing is a very minor issue, was that you always worried about exactly what the weight of the kid was as pediatrics, right?
Yeah.
As all the pediatric house staff would sit there with these calculators, right? Everything was meg per kilo per day.
Right.
Whereas the adults, I say, give them 40 milligrams of Lasix, that's fine, okay? There are very few things I actually need to calculate per meter squared with,
right.
You know? Cytoxan is probably one of the few things.
Mm-hmm.
But I have a pretty good idea as to big person, you know. But here, how much? 2.2 kilos, you know, 20 kilos.
Mm-hmm.
That was something I just didn't like. Although the science behind pediatrics, I thought, was actually at the time extremely interesting. Because one of the areas I thought about actively going into was pediatric hematology oncology, which, you know, was and still is having huge amounts of scientific success, you know, in terms of diagnostics, therapies, as well as in the molecular pathogenesis of the disease. But in the end, I think also influenced by the people I've been exposed to, like Johnny Atkinson, I ended up choosing rheumatology and internal medicine in particular.
And how did you happen to stay here? Because many people leave.
Right. So at that time, I think this was in part the one less year that I had, in terms of the clinical training. So I felt comfortable, but, you know, when you go from medical student to intern, it's actually very frightening when you just think about it. So one, I felt comfortable within the confines of Barnes because I knew where everything was, okay? I didn't have to go through where is radiology, how do I get an X-ray, this kind of thing. Two was I liked the setup of this particular residency program at the time, which was one resident, one intern. Residents always there. I looked at the Hopkins program. I considered the Hopkins program seriously, but the Hopkins program was, it was similar, one resident, but the resident goes home. So I want the resident there. And, you know, this is these are the days where, you know, the resident would tell you as he's leaving the hospital, she's leaving the hospital, feel free to call me, but calling me is a sign of weakness. All right? So you're saying, okay, should I call the resident or I shouldn't call the resident? So I think that was one of the factors, was just the way that the resident intern system was set up. Two was, you know, Barnes Hospital was and still is a very, by and large, very supportive type of hospital. And it has a number of ancillary services that you just didn't have to deal with at other places like that were more city hospital based. We still had to do a lot more scut work then than the interns have to do now. But it wasn't to the same degree as other hospitals. It was actually, you know, you knew approximately how many patients you would admit per evening on call, and it would be somewhere around 7 patients. So it was not too outlandish. I mean, I looked at the Southwestern program, and I was walking through the emergency room, and they're telling me, you know, we admit 1,200, we see 1,200 patients every 24-hour period. I said, well, how many interns are there? So there are 3 interns. I was just doing my math, and I said, this is not the place. So I think from all those factors and the fact, you know, that I only had one clinical year, I felt probably a little bit concerned about my ability to just be able to step in and be able to run the show by myself. So I just felt more comfortable within this particular confines, and hence I stay.
Well, let's wrap it up for today,
All right.
And we'll pick up tomorrow.
Okay.